I'm turning now to Psalm 56 and verse 1. Psalm 56, verse 1. Be merciful unto me, O God, for man would swallow me up. He, fighting daily, oppresseth me. And I've given a title to this brief study, David Takes Details to God. And certainly he does in prayer in this psalm take details of his predicament to God. Perhaps you might think not as many details as he employed in prayer in the preceding psalm. But anyway, it is a psalm with some detail in it, and so it prompts us to consider the subject, practical subject, of detail in prayer. This psalm, like all psalms, but this psalm is of immense importance. It teaches principles in prayer that we need throughout life's journey, and we need to bear them in mind. It teaches certain principles which will safeguard our prayers, and you'll see what I mean as we go through it. It's certainly about the believer's conquest in circumstances of great fear, and it would apply to sorrow too, fear or sorrow. David is in a terrifying situation. The inscription above the psalm would seem to point to 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 10 to 15, and I think I'll just read those few verses because it must be this passage. And David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul. He's being pursued by Saul and his military, and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Why would he go there? To the enemy. Because presumably he would hope to be received and the servants of Achish said unto him, the king, is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? The king's counselors considered this man to be their enemy, and something should be done about his coming to them and seeking some sort of asylum. And David laid up these words in his heart, and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath, that he had moved into serious trouble. And he changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad in their hands and scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. Then said Achish unto his servants, Lo, ye see the man is mad. Wherefore then have ye brought him to me? Have I need of madmen, that ye have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? David therefore departed thence, he got away, and escaped to the cave Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. Well, that, according to the inscription, would appear to be the background, the particular danger to this psalm. But we're not going to stay with that, because while it assures us that David's predicament was very serious, he was obliged to flee from Saul, who was after his life with great vehemence, and he thought that he would get asylum or security for a while with Achish, king of Gath, but alas, his counselors wouldn't permit it, and he needed then to be delivered from there. So we're assured this was a very real danger. He could not humanly see any way out of his situation. So when he pens under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, this great prayer, we're assured that the writer knew terror and danger and impossible circumstances. Well, we know that was often true in David's experience. So here's the introduction to the psalm. I'm going to give six brief sections. First of all, the first two verses, which introduce the problem. Be merciful unto me, O God, for man would swallow me up. The Hebrew is interesting. It's to do with heavy breathing or panting. It's almost an illustration in itself of some furious tyrant breathing out all kinds of threats and with great passion determined to get him and kill him. Man would swallow me up. He fighting daily, it was relentless, his problem, oppresseth me. But we can apply it to our problems and persecutions and people who speak against us and act against us and pursue us, and to the devil also, who is serving up relentlessly his constant temptations and evil suggestions, perhaps for sin, perhaps to depress us, perhaps to shake our assurance. Verse 2, mine enemies would daily swallow me up. That interesting term, verb, applies again. For they be many that fight against me. Certainly there were then the hosts of Saul and now Gath. There be many that fight against me, O thou most high. So it's going to be a prayer for help. And that introduces us to the first heading. And it's this. Well, the first heading was the problem, but the second heading is this, that David affirms his faith. Look at verse 3. What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. Here's a resolution. He interrupts his prayer. It's very important to notice it. He interrupts his crying out to God for help in his difficult, impossible situation, to make a profession and a determination. What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. That's a very important thing to learn. It's a priority. We've got problems, difficulties, things we desire to bring before the Lord. People who are have been attacking us, perhaps, in some shape or form, relentlessly, and we're becoming overwhelmed. But before we give the details, we have to affirm our faith, and we have to make this declaration, because maybe we're in fear, or we're being undermined, and we're being depressed and oppressed, and so we've got to pause, because in the Christian life and for the believer, though you can't necessarily get rid of the fear and the concern and the anxiety and the apprehension altogether, it doesn't have to have dominion. It doesn't have to rule. It doesn't have to rule your thoughts and paralyze your spiritual life. We can, by faith, overcome it. What time I am afraid, the fear continues, I will trust in thee, but it can be pushed into the background. It can be overcome by an action and a determination to trust the Lord and to look to him. So faith can conquer over fear. And David gives the example. And as he trusts in the Lord and makes his great determination, his resolution, then God helps him. Evidently, what time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. And that's important. To rehearse troubles before the Lord without some kind of determination, some kind of clear statement of faith in him, some kind of affirmation of our trust in him, is a very dangerous thing to do. To just start and proceed and get into a rehearsal of difficulties, it becomes, the prayer really becomes almost an act of self-indulgence. It almost becomes an act of self-pity. We are just complaining to ourselves Perhaps we wouldn't complain to God, we wouldn't articulate it, but we started by praying, but we're just complaining and moaning, and we're getting carried away, and it's getting us down. David doesn't do that. He begins, he introduces the problem, and he proceeds to a clear profession. Lord, I want to state this from the outset. I do trust thee, and I will trust thee, and I am trusting thee, and I'm not going to let this fear and anxiety overwhelm me. That's the second heading here in verse 3. What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. He states it in a very grand form. It is a clear affirmation. Perhaps he uses it regularly in his personal devotions. He repeats it, verse 4, in God, I will praise his word. What does he mean by that? Well, the promises that God has made to him, the promises that he's learned, the promises that we should have in the back of our Bibles when we need them, the promises of God that we should commit to memory. Perhaps he has that in mind. In God, I will praise his word. I will trust it, Lord. And so he puts his fear into the background and utters this trust before he comes to the complaint, to the details. In God, I will praise his word. In God, I have put my trust. You think of little children. In every parent has these kind of experiences, I'm sure. Children pass in and out of different phases. The child who is so good at one age may lapse into less perfect behaviour at another stage, may recover from it. However, you think of a little child, possibly. Sibling has a birthday, and the little child, whose birthday it isn't, gets very jealous and can't handle it and can't cope with it and begins to cry and perhaps throw a tantrum or a scene. Oh, this has never happened before, a parent may say. And so you try to reason with the child. But you had a lovely birthday too, only 3 weeks ago, and you had lots of presents. But it doesn't work. The child is inconsolable. No amount of reasoning will work. It won't always be the case. It may reform by the following year. Be quite different. But this year, he's inconsolable. There's no reasoning with him. He is not going to be cheered up. He's not going to be reasoned out of this situation. But we're like that sometimes with our trials and difficulties and problems before the Lord. And we rush before the Lord and pray for help. But what about this duty, this declaration, this statement of faith, this effort to trust the Lord? So the prayer is introduced. My circumstances, Lord, are desperate, but I must affirm my faith and renew my trust, and that trust must prevail over the fear and the anxiety before I proceed to the details of my prayer, or the complaints will just run away with me, and they'll just make me worse and worse, and gloomier, or more fearful. David doesn't let that happen. So there's a method in this psalm and in this prayer, and I'm sure it's there as an example to us. Verse 4 again, in God I will praise his word, in God I have put my trust, and he has proved himself to me time and again. David came to a personal knowledge of God when he was quite young, we believe. And then he had wonderful experiences, the lion and the bear, and his life was preserved. Of course, along comes Samuel and anoints him to be king and says grand words over him. And the Spirit of God enters into him from that day forward. And he has this pledge from God that God has chosen him to rule one day. And he doesn't let it go. And he's got that in mind, I'm sure. In God I will praise his word. I have the promise of God. I have that anointing. And then there was that battle with Goliath. And God inspired him to make great statements and to go into that battle so lightly armed and gave him that tremendous victory. He hasn't forgotten that. He's going to recall it. Think of it. Before he makes his detailed complaints, he reaffirms his faith. He reminds himself of the promises of God, the goodness of God, the evidences of God's power towards him. And we must do all those things. We've a duty before we get into the detail and allow our complaints to somehow seep more deeply into us and our fears or anxieties to take us over. In God I will praise his word. In God I have put my trust. What a resolution it is. Look at the words in verse 4. I will not fear what flesh can do unto me. And after all, if they take my life, it only brings me into the presence of my King and my God. But that cannot happen because I'm anointed to be king. I have that prophecy over me. And so he reassures himself. And then he proceeds to his detailed complaints. Look at them from verse 5. Every day they wrest my words. They twist my words. Who are these people twisting his words? Well, obviously the princes, the courtiers of the royal household of Gath are twisting David's words. Presumably they are doing it. But then the courtiers of Saul are also doing the same. There are people who knew David from when he was younger, from when he was the court harpist. And he was with Saul a great deal. And now perhaps they're lying about him. Oh, but even when he was younger, he said to us, I am going to be king one day. He had designs and intentions to throw the court into turmoil, even when you had him here before. And then what do you think? He's excelled with Goliath and these circumstances. He's been planning. We've heard him. We've heard him say things which to us mean he's going to mount some kind of coup or oppose you. They were lying. Somehow, I'm just guessing, they were lying about him. That's difficult in life, isn't it? And people lie about you. And you hear snippets and you put them together. And the things that may be said about you by opponents or people who dislike you, or for your faith, in your place of business, or even in your family. And it's hard to get to the bottom of it. And sometimes it's like a sword through you. Yes, take the details to the Lord, but not without a profession of faith in God's power and goodness and his promises, and remind yourself of them. Don't let your prayer actually undermine you, because it's an exercise in self-pity. So this is the remedy and this is the antidote to that. Every day they wrest my words. It's all right now for David to proceed into this detail. He's not going to be carried away easily. And notice that these are serious things. When we're saying take the details to God, he's not praying for a more comfortable life. He's not praying for little things. I would like to have this and to have that, and I'd be much happier if I could have this or do this. These are not things for himself. His life is in danger. The kingdom is at stake, the future kingdom, his whole ministry, as it were, and life for God, and what he's been called to do is in jeopardy. And so, though it involves detail, it's important detail. Things he cannot do anything about. You might pray that your reputation is being ruined, and your testimony by foolish and wicked people. What can you do? You cannot see a way of remedying this. You don't know quite who it is, but you've only heard that someone is doing it. Well, then take the detail to the Lord. Affirm your trust in him. Every day they wrest my words. All their thoughts are against me for evil. This is a serious matter. When we're talking about detail, we're not talking about trivial things or just personal comforts. They gather themselves together, verse 6. They hide themselves. They mark my steps when they wait for my soul. I think David is reviewing everything. If I escape from Gath and I go back into my land and I go back to court, well, I'm surrounded by treachery and difficulty. What will I do? Only the Lord can help me and can make my pathway clear. And then in verse 7, I'm not sure whether this is a question or a statement. Our translators make it a question here, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Shall they escape? Do they think that will they get away with what they're doing and their sin? Now, it's a very important verse, this, verse 7, because it shows us something of the mind of God and his standards. Shall they escape by iniquity, or they think they will get away with their dishonesty and their crimes? They are quite sure they will. You can have it as a question. Do they think they'll get away with their crimes? And the answer to the question is yes, they do. Or as a statement, they think they will get away with it. But you see what's behind this? This is unbelief. This is rank unbelief. People who never for a moment occurs to them, if it does, they reject the idea that there's a God in heaven who observes what they're doing. And they will have to give account for it. And they're sinning not just against David, but they're sinning against God by their lies and their schemes. So David is harassed by people, obviously, who are unbelievers. They treat standards with contempt. They don't think there's any living God or conscious God or judgment ahead for them. Now, that's the sin of unbelief, of course. God is insulted and dismissed from the scene, from the picture. And that makes David's statement wholly right. It's in line with God's justice. Look at verse 7, the second part. In thine anger, cast down the people, or those people, O God. David, you see, isn't just crying out for God just to punish people because they happen to have done something against him. He's making a statement that God will punish them because they've offended God. They do all they do in the misguided confidence that God is impotent or dead or not there. They've dismissed him, derided him. That's a greater sin than what they're actually doing. And David says, in effect, surely, Lord, the people who dismiss thee and despise thee cannot be allowed to prevail ultimately over those who love thee and believe in thee and follow after thee. That's the sense, the essence of the verse. Shall they escape by iniquity? Will they get away with what they do in their extreme unbelief? In anger, in indignation, we may say, cast down those people, O God. That's his prayer. And of course that happened. We may have to bear with things for much longer than we would like, but it's what happens in the end. In God's time, the prayer is heard. Oh Lord, can these who are so opposed to thy people be removed from the scene? Well, here's another section now in verse 8, which is, of course, that is a model statement in verse 4. In God I have put my trust. But down in verse 8, it's really very beautiful. Thou tellest my wanderings. O Lord, thou dost count my wanderings. What wanderings are these? Well, obviously, David's running from Saul, from place to place as it went on, to Gath in this instance. He's not following a lifestyle which is purposeful and profitable to God among his people or over his people. He's just compelled to flee from place to place. He calls them his wanderings, but he makes in verse 8 a repeated statement of faith. You see how the psalm runs? It's introduced, the problem is stated, immediately there's a resolution or a determination. I will trust in the Lord and not let fear prevail. Then he prays the details, what the people are doing, and he calls upon God to help. And then he immediately goes back to repeating his statements of faith in God. O Lord, thou dost number my wanderings. I'm watched, I'm observed. And not only is God observing each phase, each event, but he's taking account of them. He's adding them up. He's noting them. He's going to bless me, protect me, turn them to my account. By them, he's going to train me for something in the future. You can almost hear David thinking these possibilities. He's preparing me for future service and calling. And then he proceeds in verse 8 here, put thou my tears into thy bottle. Some people think these are the tears that he sheds in prayer as he appeals to God. Phase after phase of persecution or running from Saul, and he prays in different circumstances and situations, and he calls upon God to remember his pleas, his tears. Others say, well, that may well be so, but it would include his grief and sorrow as terrible things are done to him and said about him, the grief that he suffers. Put them into thy bottle. The bottle is, of course, something like a water skin, something made of leather for holding liquids. In other words, David is assured that God will not forget any one of his prayers or any one of his sorrows or hardships. They're all going to be made to count. They're all going to be recompensed. They're all going to be rewarded. And he changes the figure here from bottle into book. Put thou my tears into thy bottle. Remember them, Lord. Well, he's assured God will do so. Are they not in thy book? So he's got two forms of recording in his illustration, assigned to God. The bottle would represent something which is going to be used, and the book would represent something which is going to be remembered. There's a history book written. Every woe, every sorrow, every sacrifice, every difficulty, and the Lord will bless it and make use of it. Maybe for the comfort and help of others. Let me read those famous verses from 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, says Paul, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble, by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. And he proceeds with even further facts about this, how God uses every trial, because every comfort is going to ultimately be conveyed to someone else in need. So verse 9, this affirmation comes clearly. when I cry unto thee, then shall mine enemies turn back. This I know, for God is for me. A certain affirmation. He doesn't know when. He doesn't know exactly how. But it will be so in God's time. David knows that God may deliver him, or he may strengthen him to bear it, but he's not going to let the fear, or equally it could be the sorrow, rule in his heart and paralyze his thinking and his worship and his service. This I know, for God is for me. And in verse 10, the repeated, in God will I praise his word. In the Lord will I praise his word. Of course, going back to 1 Samuel and chapter 21, I read into chapter 22 the outcome of what is called an escape here from Gath. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam, where he had the immense encouragement of up to 400 people come to assist him. They were not noble people, distinguished people. They were failures, they were outcasts, they were people who had been indebted and so on. But nevertheless, the man who was one moment lonely was the next surrounded by people who would make him their captain and who would support him. So God reversed his circumstances. I won't go into the manner of his deliverance this evening, but coming back to Psalm 56, there's that tremendous repeated statement in verse 11. In God have I put my trust. I will not be afraid what man can do unto me. Well, will you say that twice? In a prayer for relief or deliverance from difficulty or from heartache or from satanic evil suggestions? How can you be a Christian? How can you be any use? And so on. Will you use these kind of statements? David does. And then verse 12. Thy vows are upon me, O God. Well, what he means is that when he prayed to God, he clearly made certain vows. He promised God that on deliverance he would praise him. He may, in the context of the times, have promised God that he would make a special thank offering. He may have promised the Lord that he would redouble his efforts to serve him in this way or in that way. And we do the same, or should do. If the Lord will help me, then I will serve him the more in good works, in the helping of others, in the witness to those in need as he gives me opportunity, in promoting my dear Saviour and speaking of him in all manner of ways. We should make our promises, and then when we're delivered, keep them, thy vows. Or we might put it today, the vows that I have made. Thy vows, he calls them God's vows. They're clearly his vows that he's made to God, are upon me, like a burden, in a way, like a debt that I must now pay. I cannot forget them. I will render praises unto thee. Perhaps that was the principal vow. For thou hast delivered. It hasn't happened yet, but he's speaking as though God has as good as done it, because he's prayed. For thou hast delivered my soul from death. Wilt thou not deliver my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the light of the living? Thou hast delivered my soul from death, from the lion and the bear, from Goliath, from other trials. Then surely if God has kept him alive, he will deliver him from falling as a person into fear and faithlessness, from falling into the intimidating scorn of his enemies, that I may walk before God in the light of the living. What's the light of the living? I'm sure he means something like sensed communion with God, certain assurance, the daily enjoyment of his word, the daily challenge and comfort and instruction of his word, the light of the living, the guidance of God. There are so many forms of light for the Lord's people. Thou hast delivered my soul from death. Wilt not thou deliver my feet from falling? The reasoning passages of the Bible. It's not quite the same, but it reminds me very much of Romans 8, those great words. What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? Here's the reasoning. He that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? It is God that justifieth. Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And it all started, the chain of reasoning. He that spared not his own son, he who has done the greatest thing imaginable for us, Christ has come and taken our sin and our death and borne it away. How shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Thou hast delivered my soul from death. Wilt not thou deliver my feet from falling? God will keep his people and keep them securely. So that's the psalm. The problem stated, verses 1 and 2. A great resolution made, determination, affirmation of faith. That's a vital priority. Dear friends, we mustn't forget it whenever we go to prayer with details of problems. Then come the details, but they are important details, not just trivial things for personal comfort. And then immediately they're curbed and a great statement of trust appears once again. And then there are those statements of anticipation, of blessing. And finally, the burst of praise. Thy vows are upon me, O God, I will render praises unto thee, for thou hast delivered my soul from death. Wilt not thou deliver my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the land of the living? The Lord will hear our details, but try to keep them in this glorious context. That's the lesson of the psalm to the prayer of every earnest believer. I'm going to keep it just there this evening. The psalm is short. The principles are clear. The message must be short and remain clear also. Let's close singing the hymn 457.